Coming up on Triangulation, the author of The History of the Future dives into Oculus, Facebook, and so much more. Blake Harris joins me next on Triangulation.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 389, recorded March 11th for March 15th, 2019. Blake J. Harris, The History of the Future. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Capterra. Find the right tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Visit Capterra's free website at capterra.com/triangulation. Hello and welcome to another episode of Triangulation. I'm Jason Howell. This is, of course, the show, one of my favorite shows on the network, because I get the chance to talk to really cool people, people who are writing about technology, people who are living technology, breathing technology. It's kind of what we do here at Twit. And today is no exception. Joining me today is Blake J. Harris. He is the author of The History of the Future, Oculus, Facebook, and the Revolution That Swept Virtual Reality. Blake J. Harris, welcome to the show.
Hey, I have a quick disclaimer for your audience. I am probably not a really cool person, but okay. I did spend a few years writing about really cool people, and I really appreciate you having me on the show. Thanks, Jason.
Absolutely. Sometimes the way to get cool is to surround yourself by cool people.
That's true. It's a good strategy. You're right.
That's a strategy that I continue to try, and I keep failing. It's just a part of my life. So I'm really happy to have you here. You are not just the author of this awesome book that it came out last week, right?
It came out, I think, 2 weeks ago. It came out at the end of February.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, it's fresh off the presses.
And
you can get it right now. But you're also the author of a book that I'm sure many of our viewers have read at this point or listened to in audiobook format, Console Wars, which kind of focused entirely on Sega and Nintendo in the 90s and kind of the battle within there. I would say a lot of people consider that book to be required reading if your passion is retro gaming. It's kind of fits into that library perfectly.
Yeah. Well, thanks for saying that.
Yeah.
I wrote that book. It came out in 2014. Prior to that, I was a struggling writer whose day job was trading commodities for Brazilian clients. So that was writing that book was life changing in so many ways. And
I'm sure
it really is just this incredible behind the scenes story of Sega and Nintendo, mostly focused on Sega. And for me, it was just like a, you know, both these books in a sense are like long, hopefully compelling business case studies. So, you know, it was very educational for me to speak to all these people and to put that story out there.
And an opportunity for you to be able to get close to the history of these things that I'm sure you were passionate about. I know I was passionate about, you know, I had a Sega Genesis and, you know, Super Nintendo. Like, it's awesome when you have a passion and you can figure out some way to get close to the people around it. Not only does that make you an expert, but it just feels kind of neat to be involved.
Oh, writing that book was like a behind the scenes tour of my childhood. And I'm pretty good with not geeking out or not getting starstruck, but definitely talking to Tom Kalinske and Alan Nilsson and Peter Main and folks at Nintendo and Sega, I had to keep it in check because they really were people that I often say during interviews that Tom Kalinske was the adult most responsible for my childhood, other than my parents, from, you know, his adventures at Mattel or before that with He-Man with Flintstones Chewable Vitamins. But yeah, I mean, these people shaped our childhood, and
absolutely,
that I think to some degree was sort of one of the most subtle to me, but maybe very obvious to others, biggest change between this most recent book and the last book was, you know, obviously Console Wars happened 20 years ago, but I did feel like there was a little something different about writing about people who were older than me, who had been adults, you know, in boardrooms making decisions that impacted my childhood versus writing about people my own age. Not better, not worse, but it was a different experience.
Yeah, and I'm sure one experience kind of fed into the other as far as your process, obviously this being your second book. I should also mention that you've been on Triangulation before. You are on Triangulation episode 155 with Leo Laporte. This was June 2014. And of course, then you were supporting, you know, that was your appearance to support the release of Console Wars. So anyone who's interested in diving into the topics around Console Wars at a deeper level should definitely check out episode 155 of Triangulation, and you'll find Blake talking all about that history. But I do want to kind of touch a little bit around console wars, because I think there's sure. some interesting aspects as like from the perspective of being an author, writing a first book and kind of some of the decisions that you've made there and how that translates into where you are right now. I kind of came across some information as far as like how you became an author, and I would describe it as kind of by accident, right? Tell us a little bit about how you actually found yourself writing Console Wars in the beginning. Like, you weren't an author prior to this. You talked a little bit about your job, but sure. Was that bug always there? Did you always want to write? And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I guess it's a question of how far back do we want to go. But you know, as a kid, it wasn't necessarily that I wanted to be a writer. I assumed that I would be a professional athlete for no reason at all, other than that I liked watching sports. By the time I got to college, I got really into writing, but I was mostly writing fiction and mostly trying to write the great American novel, which I wrote, I thought, twice, but publishers did not agree. And you know, by the end of college, I really did not know how to move going forward, because I knew at that point, by 21, 22, that I definitely wanted to be a writer, but I had no idea how to monetize that passion and potentially that skill set. And so I ended up taking a job trading commodities for Brazilian clients. And I did that for 7 years, living in New York, working out of Rockefeller Center, where the Christmas tree goes up every year, which was always a nice respite from the trading. And so, you know, I was trading sugar and coffee and soybeans. And then at night, I was working mostly on screenwriting. I produced a couple of movies. The first one that I really did and that I co-wrote was a mockumentary about competitive rock, paper, scissors that was very much inspired by The Office and Arrested Development and stuff around that time. And I guess, again, foolishly, like when I assumed I would be a professional athlete, I just assumed that this would like win Sundance and I'd be handed briefcases of money. But of course, you know, reality set in. And so for a long while, I was just writing and trying to build up my portfolio and trying to get representation and all of that. And then I guess in hindsight, the big turning point was one that at the time was really it felt really unfortunate, which was that my writing partner and I spent about 6 months writing a script that we assumed and hoped and seemed reasonably this time to launch our career. It was called The Sordid Tales of an Evil Tyrannical Ex-Dictator, about a Ricky Gervais type of dictator from a wealthy European country whose life is threatened and he ends up working at the DMV in New Jersey, very much inspired by, you know, 80s films like Coming to America and Trading Places. But anyway, we found out right before our manager was going to take that to the market that Sacha Baron Cohen was doing a movie called The Dictator. And even though he hadn't written it yet, our script was immediately worthless. And I understood why, too, because why would you, you know, I'd much rather trust a script from a time tested and proven talent like Sacha Baron Cohen than me and my buddy Jonah. Sure. But anyway, I mentioned that because for me, that I was about 28 at that point, and I remember thinking to myself, like, oh, I'm going to quit writing, you know, sort of saying this out of spite, as if anyone really cared that I was going to quit writing other than my wife or my parents. And I realized that that just was never going to happen, that maybe in the back of my mind, I always assumed that there was sort of this thing like, you know, if I don't make by the time I'm 30 or 40 or whatever, I'm going to quit doing this thing I love. And I sort of realized that I've never quit doing this thing that I love, but it did seem unlikely that I was ever going to make a career out of it. So I decided that whatever I do, right, whatever I do, whatever projects I work on, I need to really, really, really love the project, because, you know, the same thing could happen again that happened with Sacha Baron Cohen. And that led me to Console Wars. Initially, before I set out to write Console Wars, I really just wanted to read it. My brother had purchased a Sega Genesis for my 29th, I think, or 28th birthday. And you know, I started playing old games again. This was the system that we had when we were kids. And, you know, my favorite kinds of books to read are always behind the scenes business stories, stuff by Michael Lewis, Ben Mesrick, like The Smartest Guys in the Room, Disney War, those kinds of books. So I went to a Barnes & Noble here in Manhattan and was looking for the video game history section. I assumed it would be near the film history section or the music history section, but there was no such section. They didn't have a single book in the entire store about video games or the history of video games. All they had in the entire gigantic store were walkthrough guides. And, you know, it wasn't like I left the Barnes & Noble that day and thought like, aha, I'm going to write Console Wars, or I'm going to try to fill this demand that I believe exists. But that was kind of the early stages of me writing it, of the idea. And then when it really came together was when I started interviewing people. And you know, and to your question about how I got into this and how I sort of accidentally fell into this, you know, I had never interviewed anybody before. I also, even at that point, didn't know that I was going to write a book. I thought maybe it would be a movie script. Maybe it was just my own personal curiosity guiding me. But the more people that I spoke with, the more I realized that there was this incredible behind-the-scenes story with Sega and Nintendo. And then that was sort of clinched after I spoke with Tom Kalinske, who's you know, the protagonist of Console Wars, and he was the president of Sega of America from 1990 to 96, when Sega went from 5% of the market up to 55% and then fell back down. And I remember after my first call with him, I think it was a 2-hour call, I just was like, basically turned to my wife and was like, I want to spend the next few years working on this. And so I did. And it was a, an up and down experience. But I did wake up every day pretty excited to write about Sega and Nintendo because, like I said earlier, it was like a behind-the-scenes look at my childhood, and every day was filled with interesting stories. It was kind of hard to balance that with my day job at the time, but I made it work, and I'm glad that with this new book, I did not have to balance it with a day job.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of made the crossover, the transition into this being your day job, and yes. That's awesome. And I should just also say, you're lucky, like you're fortunate that you made that realization that you could pursue something that you love, that you're passionate about, and turn that into something. Like, not everybody has the insight into themselves to make that realization or to understand how to make that happen. Obviously, when you're passionate about something, it's a really great driver, right? It pushes you in certain directions that if you aren't passionate about something, you might have a hard time going to. So I would say you're well done on making that realization. And with your history around, you know, film and writing screenplays and stuff, that actually explains a lot as far as kind of the tone or the narrative style that you employ. You even mentioned at the start of the history of the future, there's a section in there that talks about, it was the author's note that talks about how you construct your dialogue. You know, obviously you had a lot of collaboration with former employees of Oculus and Facebook. You had a lot of information being shared back and forth, but no one was in the room when these conversations happened. So you had, as an author, you had to make a choice, like how do you tell a narrative story that is both historical but also entertaining and includes all the facts that you've gathered? Talk a little bit about that choice, because I think it's perhaps a little, I think some people are okay with it. Some people may be less okay with it. You know?
Well, no, you don't need to beat around the bush. So, you know, Console Wars came out in 2014. I do feel very lucky and generally just like humbled by how successful it's been. But I think that it's fair to say that there's, I don't know, like a 75 to 80% of people really seem to like the book a lot, and about 20 to 25% of the book seem to think it's the worst nonfiction book ever written. And amongst that 20 to 25%, a lot of them complain or, you know, cite the dialogue as the reason that they don't like it. I can understand where they're coming from to some degree. My one regret with Console Wars was that I wish in the author's note I had mentioned how close the collaboration had been with the subjects, just so that if anyone out there thought like I was just lying in bed making up cool dialogue, that wasn't right. How it went. I think some people also got that too, because it was a 550-page book. So it wasn't, you know, like a quickly written thing that was, you know, like people could tell that there was a lot of research that went into it. But at the same time, there was some, I thought that there was some validity to the complaint, more so that I wish I had been more specific about my process. And then, you know, that was very much in the back of my mind coming into the history of the future. At first, I kind of considered maybe writing a much drier, encyclopedic sort of history. And then I realized that, you know, the reason that I had chosen that style, that in the room, in the mind, fly on the wall style with Console Wars was to service the story, to service the characters. And so I felt that, you know, sort of doing what maybe protect me the most from criticism was not the best thing to actually tell the story of Oculus and Facebook. And so I thought that kind of wouldn't be fair to them. But at the same time, I wanted to learn from my first experience. And in the intervening years, I had, I've co-directed part of, we're still in production on the Console Wars documentary. And right. More importantly, I've done like I don't know, 60 oral histories about movies, many of them with the How Did This Get Made gang. So it's most of them are bad movies. But, you know, I had become much more familiar and with the documentary and oral history formats. And so my rule, my rule with this book was essentially that every line of dialogue that is in the History of the Future is a line that is verbatim that I have on audio somewhere. And it's either the subject themselves explaining what they said, them saying, here's what I heard. Or I guess in some cases it was truly secondhand where someone heard that someone had something. Though I tried to keep that as much to a minimum, but due to some of the legal issues later on that I'm sure we'll get into with covering the book and NDAs, that was sort of a necessity. But I did want to make sure that all the dialogue did come from the sources themselves, or at least come from somebody who was there and who had memories of these conversations. And to your point, you know, like I think it's super important that history books, particularly ones that, you know, are not about life and death stuff. I think that it's important that they be entertaining, or at least that's what I want to read. And, you know, you said that my screenwriting background probably helps inform you a little bit about the style for Console Wars in this book and the choices that I made. And I'm sure that, to a sizable degree, that's true. But it's also like, I think it's more, from my perspective, it's more that's partly why I was drawn to screenwriting. Just the idea of like bringing scenes to life, and maybe that's a long-winded way of saying that even before I was officially, you know, doing screenwriting, my favorite books to read were always entertaining books, nonfiction or otherwise. Like in college, I actually started a book club. The first book that I selected was The Da Vinci Code. And I remember, you know, typically book clubs would attract more literary minded, maybe highbrow sorts of people. And they were surprised that I wanted to read The Da Vinci Code. But I thought that, the way that Dan Brown was able to pack a lot of research into this book, combined with the fact that it was such an entertaining story, you know, regardless of how highbrow it was, I thought that was amazing. And so that's sort of always been my objective. And it crystallized for me while I was writing Console Wars, when, you know, I go from trading commodities and, you know, in a brokerage to being at home every day at my desk and thinking about who's on the other end of this. You know, prior to Console Wars, the only person who really read my work was my parents and my girlfriend, or sometimes my brother, but this was going to be, you know, for a wider audience. But it was me thinking about my parents, my girlfriend, and especially my grandmother. You know, I really always think of my grandma when I write. I want to make sure that what I'm writing, even if it's a high-tech story about virtual reality or video game consoles, that it could still appeal to my grandma. And maybe I'm not always successful in that, but I think that's just a good barometer to try to figure out how to tell the story in a way that a total layperson could appreciate. And with both of these books, you know, the solution from my perspective has been to make it very character-driven stories and to really ground it in these people, their ideas, and the relationships with one another.
Yeah, and I think you did a fantastic job in both books doing that, right? Like, they're entertaining reads, even, you know, at the same time learning a lot about the history. And I truly believe, personally, as far as creativity is concerned, make what you want to see, right? Like, if this is right, if this speaks to your heart, then that's the right way to go, and people will guaranteed people are going to connect to it. Maybe not everybody; they wanted a different kind of book, but these people absolutely. And I think it just makes for an even more entertaining, engaging read, and obviously, it makes it more accessible to a wider range of people.
Thanks.
So, yeah, no, good stuff.
I'm glad you said that. I mean, even going back to, you know, you said that I was lucky to sort of realize that, you know, how much passion, how much a part of the process passion should be, and to, you know, decide to go more towards a passion route than a commercial route. And I just want to say that, you know, I guess at this point now I've been interviewing for the course of the past 10 years or 8 years. And there's obviously no, formula for success, you know, one size fits all formula. Yeah. But whenever I'm talking to people like Mel Brooks, or athletes or tech people, it does seem to be that, a lot of people have stories like mine where they were trying this thing, trying to make it as an actor, director, whatever, musician. And then when they sort of tried to stop being what they thought they were supposed to be and just kind of did the project that was for passion that maybe they didn't expect to make money on, a lot of times that is what ends up breaking through. And there really is something to that, to letting the passion drive you. And also to what you're saying, you know, to basically write the kind of book that I want to read myself, which from my perspective was like I love Ben Mezrich's books, but yeah. There's a reason that my books are twice the size of his. And it's because I always wish that, like, when he's talking about, you know, Zuckerberg and the starting Facebook and the accidental billionaires, I wish that there was like two pages about MySpace and Friendster and basically like what else had been going on in the, you know, social network community. So, I want my books to have more of that context. But obviously I love his and they were a big inspiration.
Yeah. And make no bones about it. This looks like a thick book. That's because it is. It's nearly 500 pages, which makes you happy, especially when you realize that it's a good book and it's 500 pages. It's the kind that you burn through pretty quickly. So, well, we're going to talk about what's actually in the book. I love talking about process. I love talking about kind of what it takes to make and create and all that kind of stuff. We're going to talk a little bit about the topics inside. You know, largely that is Oculus, Facebook, Palmer, Lucky. We'll dive into that in a second. But first, let's take a break. We need to thank the sponsor of this episode, and then we'll do that. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Capterra. We've all read surprising online reviews. I'm sure you have before. Whether you're trying to get a sweet deal on something that you've been saving for, you're trying to find the best happy hour in town, whatever it happens to be, it's generally a good idea to read a review first so that you kind of know what to expect. So why should finding the right software be any different? Software for your business, you want to know how people who are running businesses similar to yours, how they feel about the software that they're using. And, you know, you can read thousands of real software reviews to do that and find the right software for your business at capterra.com/triangulation. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 750,000 reviews of products from real software users, you can discover everything that you need to make an informed decision. You can search more than 700 specific categories of software, everything from project management to email marketing to yoga studio management software. Yes, yoga studio management software is in there. No matter what kind of software your business needs, Capterra makes it easy to find and discover the right solution and fast. Join the millions of people who use Capterra each month to find the right tools for their business. Capterra just makes it easy. Everything's easy to find. Click through. You find everything in kind of linked categories so you can see all of your choices, dive in, download, try, understand and learn more about the terms behind them. All that stuff is made easy to find with Capterra. So check out Capterra's free website. Visit capterra.com/triangulation to find the right tools to make an informed software decision in particular for your business. That's capterra.com/triangulation, CAPTERRA.com/triangulation. Capterra, software selection simplified, and we thank Capterra for their support of Triangulation. So before you started writing this book, did you know that it was going to focus so heavily on a guy named Palmer Luckey and Oculus, or did you jump into this thinking, I like VR, let's write a book about VR, and then poof, everything changed?
Big question. Other side question is, did I know that Palmer was going to get fired while I was still writing
the book? Yes.
But it's a good question. And I particularly like it because I was thinking about, basically the first 20 minutes of our conversation, like about my background and sort of my own origin story. And as you know from reading this book and Console Wars, I do put a lot of I spend a lot of time describing the origin stories of various products and particularly people. And because I think that, there's a lot, people can change, but often they don't, or often the clues of our personality are there throughout, which is a long-winded way of saying that what appealed to me about Console Wars was obviously the Sega Nintendo of it all, but really it was the people. And it was the same case here. So I would say that I the experience for me started with me thinking like, wow, VR seems like the coolest thing ever. And sort of the question of like taking off the headset for the first time. And like so many people, I thought like, wow, that's the future. and sort of trying to figure out, like, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And more importantly, from a business standpoint, like, how do you monetize that? Like, even if someone invented a time machine tomorrow, let's say a time machine where you can't alter the past, but where you can visit the past, like, you know, we would say, like, wow, that's so cool. But, like, what is actually the business, or what is actually, what are you going to do with this? How is this going to impact culture? And so when I pitched the book to HarperCollins in July of 2015, so 3.5 years ago, you know, I talked to them about the Oculus story, talked to them about how just a couple months earlier, HTC and Valve had announced a competitor called the Vive, and how Sony was working on this, and how, you know, but I didn't know who the main characters would be. I think it's, from at least to me as a writer, it's important to not know that at the start. And sort of, you know, good evidence of that is that I was looking back at some old emails that I sent to people that I was wanting to interview, and the way that I described the book back then was like basically like, you know, Console Wars 2.0 VR edition, in the sense that like, I saw these big names, Valve, HTC, Sony, Google was getting into VR with Cardboard and Daydream. And I assumed that it was like this big battle royale of Goliaths, obviously Facebook and Oculus. But when I actually spoke to these people, I did not get a sense that the competition was what was defining the industry. It really was much more of collaboration. And then that was sort of what led me to the realization that this was not really a story about corporate competition. This was a story about technological revolution and just revolutions in general, and what it takes for, you know, people to pull off a revolution, how much it's based on ideas and sort of like the myth of the revolution. But all that said, I did know early on that Oculus would be a significant part of the story, because the role that they played in resurrecting consumer VR. And the extent of that was sort of based on two things. One was the level of access. You know, we've talked a little bit about my writing style, and also just my philosophy is I kind of don't like the idea of writing about people who don't want to be written about, or maybe I don't like the idea of writing about people who don't talk to me, who I don't actually know, and have gotten a sense of them, and have their input on certain things. So getting access was huge, and I reached out to Palmer Luckey in July of 2015. We ended up going back and forth. At the time, he told me that he felt it was premature for a book to be written, that Oculus hadn't accomplished anything yet, that they were now facing this enormous challenge of going from niche gaming toy to mainstream consumer electronics device, but at the same time, him and his colleagues were big fans of Console Wars, so they you know, were open to having a discussion. And so I ended up going back and forth. I went out there in December 2015, but it still took 14 months after that to finally get the access that I wanted, which was granted to me in February of 2016, which was an exciting time. 1 month before Oculus launched their first product, the first mm-hmm. consumer product, the CV1, the Oculus Rift. And man, did the following year not turn out anywhere at all like they had expected in so many ways. Yeah. And then the other thing too is just in terms of like the scope of the story and how much it really did end up being almost basically entirely about Oculus. Like I would have said early on, I would have just thrown out like, you know, 50 or 60% Oculus, 40% other interesting stories with developers, competitors, and all that. And there is some of that. And there's a decent amount of that in the book. But like the thing I noticed was that during the first year or two, you know, I would go to these VR websites every day, like Upload VR or Road to VR, you know, these VR focused sites. And every day there would be a new company or a new product that's, you know, was the biggest thing ever. It was, you know, or promised to change everything. And I hope, you know, I didn't know which ones would, and I hoped that many of them would. But I guess I started to realize that as the scope of the story seemed to expand, like the scope of my narrative should really shrink. And I remember the analogy I was thinking of was of the TV show Mad Men, you know, the quote, mm-hmm. a quote from Mad Men opens the book. But basically, like, if you're going to tell a story about advertising in the 1960s, you can, you know, tell a story with 10 different companies and various different vantage points at these companies, or you can tell the story about one company, about Sterling Cooper, and through Sterling Cooper see all of this. And I felt like that was the best way to do it, because at least I knew that Oculus was historically significant for a handful of reasons. And then also I felt like with Mad Men, when you do focus on a singular narrative, you're able to get a lot more into the cultural aspects of the time than if you're trying to balance, you know, 8 or 10 different ACD, et cetera, stories, where you really do have to stay a little bit closer to the business side.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, Oculus, you know, of all the companies, if you did have to narrow your focus, I mean, Oculus is really the place to narrow to, because I mean, largely Palmer Luckey and what he did with the very early, you know, advancements that he did around VR, his passion around this, like he's really just a pivotal person, like one of the pivotal people involved in bringing VR back from the doldrums that were the 90s VR revolution, in air quotes, that really didn't end up doing anything. He's the one that really had any sort of drive or passion around VR to do something on his own, communicate that to the world via, you know, these forums and everything, and for that to spark this this thing that we see now. VR is everywhere. It's tamed down a little bit, but it's still a big part of the picture.
Yeah. I think, and you know, the other big part of it too is John Carmack. I guess, you know, when I do a lot of these oral histories and pieces about the making of movies, particularly bad movies, like I said, but there's always this question, you know, whenever you see a movie, especially nowadays, you know, there's a long list of producers. It could be 3, 5, 50, whatever. Yeah. But I sort of see part of my job in answering how did this get made is to sort of try to identify which producers or which participants in a project are the reason why it happened. Like if not for them, there would be no project. And that's largely, I think, what appealed to me about Oculus. Like whether or not VR is, you know, in a trough of disillusionment right now, or whether, you know, looking back on where we were 8 years ago with, you know, we're in an incredible place with VR, that's a matter of perspective. But I do think it's sort of objectively possible to say that if not for Oculus, if not for Palmer, if not for John Carmack reaching out to Palmer, we wouldn't be anywhere like this. And yeah, and that's what fascinates me narratively. I think sometimes, you know, that might then make people think that what the other companies have done, like Sony and HTC and Valve and all these others, that I don't value those contributions. And obviously I do. I just like to sort of look at the originator. I like to tell origin stories. And so, you know, like you said, Palmer starting in 2009, and then for the next 3 years was first living in a garage, then living in a trailer, and just building these prototypes. And it's so hard to imagine, though I tried my best to depicted in the first chapter, but it's so hard to imagine what it was like back then for Palmer to be working on this thing that everyone thought was the stupidest thing in the world. You know, even his parents, and his parents are, you know, from my perspective, like they're very good, supportive parents, loving parents, but they wanted their son to like get a real job or to work on technology that might actually lead to a real job. And you have Palmer obsessed with this thing that, like you said, everyone thought died in the 90s. And I think that that's really, I find that admirable, but at the least, I think it's fascinating that someone would obsess over something that few people seem to care about. Though little did we know that, you know, his goal was to make all of us care about it, and how successful he ended up being in that regard.
Well, and maybe that wasn't even his goal in the beginning. I mean, you know, he was a teenager after all. So, you know, and I remember being a teenager and being very obsessed about certain things, video games, music, or whatever. And so, you know, that would drive you to certain places. Of course, he started collecting VR kind of headsets and stuff, and his passion just became more and more cultivated around that, and that kind of led to where he was. And then, of course, you know, he meets Carmack, all, you know, big business essentially at some point starts to become very aware of what Palmer's doing with the Rift. Do you think Palmer was equipped at that point to handle? I mean, here he's I think he's no longer a teenager by the time, you know, he's probably like 20 or 21 by the time big businesses say, hey, we like what you're doing here. Was he equipped to kind of enter into this new realm, this new world with his hardware and his passion?
That's a really good question. And there's sort of two points I want to hit on there. One is that because of what happens later in the book with Palmer end up getting fired because of his personality, which is very, very much larger than life. You know, he's not afraid to dress up in a bikini to you know, in a cosplay at a Comic-Con, you know, basically attending these festivals or going to Japan and dressing up in a bikini for cosplay. You know, he's very opinionated. And so a lot of people over the past couple of years have suggested to me that that his decisions were the result of him being immature. And maybe that's true. But I also think that after speaking with Palmer almost every day for 3 years and probably knowing him better than almost anyone in the world, that I think that's just Palmer. I think that 20 years from now, he's going to be the same way, for better or worse. I sort of came to realize that he to me is like the adult version of Kevin McAllister from Home Alone. this like boy, you know, very boyish, this boyish personality that is, you know, charismatic to the point of arrogance, and in some ways is kind of arrogant, but still is somehow charming, always very resourceful, liking to build stuff and, you know, defend his home and all that. So I say all that because of what I'm about to say next in terms of, like, was he prepared for what he was basically about to get himself into? And I think that the answer is yes, as much as anyone could be. Like, yeah, I think that yeah. he was as prepared as a 40-year-old, but I don't think anyone until they do it for the second time, maybe. I don't think anyone is really prepared for what happens when you sell your baby, when you sell your company, especially because, you know, in almost every case, what leads to your sale is like a mutual interest and seemingly shared vision with the acquirer. And so you sort of feel like, oh, we're all on the same page here. This is all going to work out. And talking to other people in the book, you know, whether it's like Paul Bettner or Brendan Areeb, who was – you know, mm-hmm. Palmer's co-founder and CEO, like, it just never ends up that way. You know, it just, you know, I hope that entrepreneurs who sell their company do find, you know, do end up happy. I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it does seem to be a very universal thing of what happens when you sell your company and you lose control. And so I think that he was as prepared as anyone could be for that. But I think that's just something you can't really be prepared for.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, to a certain degree, he was lucky to have advocates like Carmack and Areeb in his corner. I'm sure, you know, they were able to help him through. I mean, when one of the largest companies in the world comes along and offers you literally billions of dollars to buy your company, that I feel like to anyone who hasn't probably made something or been super passionate about, you know, something that they've created, that seems like a no-brainer. I have to imagine that was kind of difficult for Palmer. You know, on one hand, you've got literally bags of money, you're sleeping on a bed of money, but on the other hand, there's this thing that you're relinquishing control. And ultimately, you know, that was kind of his downfall, right? You talked a little bit about elements of his personality, which we'll definitely talk about here in a few. That kind of led to him being let go from Facebook, which means that his baby Oculus was no longer his. That's a risk, right? When you allow a company like Facebook to hand over those buckets full of money your way for the technology that you created, that's a risk that you take. And I have to imagine that was a hard decision for him to make.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it's obviously Mad Men is one of my favorite shows and was an inspiration for how to tell the story. But that quote at the front of the book is, to me, Silicon Valley in a nutshell, where Peggy Olson says to Don Draper, "You never say thank you." And he responds and says, "That's what the money is for." And so, you know, there's always all these hugs and handshakes and smiles about how we're going to do this thing together. And then at some point along the way, things don't work out for whatever reason. And, you know, often if there's a financial transaction involved, that seems to absolve the party that, you know, is seeming to hurt the other one or not appreciate the other one. In terms of like how hard it was, you know, so one of the things that was very interesting with this book and very helpful to me, although it was a lot more work, but I loved doing this work, was like, you know, with Console Wars being a story that happened 20 to 25 years ago, there were so few remaining archival documents, though I was able to get more than I would have expected. But like, you know, there's also no email back then. So I sort of realized early on that where, you know, Console Wars or even Mad Men, like, these are stories largely about meetings between people. And in Console Wars, those happened in boardrooms. And nowadays, a lot of those meetings happen by email or happen on web forums. And that's sort of a long-winded way of saying that memory can be faulty, or people have incentives to remember things differently. And maybe that was the case in Console Wars, but that's at least, you know, why you try to confirm with multiple sources. But with this book, it was so different because, like you said, you know, Palmer was on this web forum from 2009, 2012. So there's thousands of messages in there, or thousands of posts that I've read through. And I also went through, like, I think 25,000 internal documents, mostly emails. And so I have a very good sense for what people were actually feeling at the time. And so when you ask about, that existential decision of selling your company, it's interesting to go back to something that I don't even think is mentioned in the book, but in around 2012, after John Carmack shows Palmer's prototype at E3, and there's all this excitement around the Oculus Rift and Palmer and virtual reality, somebody on Meant to Be Seen 3D, the forum that he used to post on, asked, said something like, we thought you were selling out, or we thought you were going to sell out. And he said something to the effect of that he would never sell his product or his company unless it was for the best of VR. And I mention all that to say that, I don't think that these guys all realized what they were getting into with the sale to Facebook. But more importantly, I think that even if you asked all of them today, even people like Brendan, who's no longer with the company either, or Michael Antonov, who's still with Oculus, but he's a co-founder of Oculus, but he's not actually he's still at Facebook, but he no longer works for Oculus. I think if you ask these people, and I did most recently ask Mike Antonov, because he was the one that was most vocally against the Facebook deal, do you regret doing this? And none of them, I think, would say that they do, because they all think that the acquisition was the best thing to happen to VR, which I think is a really interesting subject to debate, because I don't know whether that's true or not. But it definitely spurred a lot of investment.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And VR being a new technology, it requires a lot of investment. It requires a lot of money to build up that technology. And what better way to do that than join, link your technology or VR system with the company that probably has the most money to throw at it. I think history probably, it remains to be seen whether in history will look back and say, oh yeah, that really was a really great choice. But it did give the market at least some sort of thumbs up. You're right. It did say, well, Facebook says
for sure
that this is something that's worth throwing this amount of money into. We should all do the same. We should all, get on board. And as far as the overall kind of promise of VR, maybe we aren't quite where it needs to be or where we hope it would be. But I imagine through that, we're further along than we probably would have been without.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. In short term, speaking from a technological standpoint, yeah, or from a consumer product standpoint, the Facebook acquisition, we would be nowhere where we are. We're nowhere near where we are right now without that.
Yeah.
I think I've just been thinking a lot of I guess my answer a few weeks ago would have been like, yes, of course, selling to Facebook was the best thing for VR. There's no doubt about it, because Facebook didn't just pay $3 billion for Oculus. They've also invested $2 to $3 billion over the past few years, and they've also led other VCs to investing in VR and other companies. But then, I was at this book signing a week and a half ago, and somebody asked me, they mentioned how Oculus and Facebook have a new VR headset coming out called Oculus Quest, which is like the first standalone 6 degrees of freedom, all in one solution that's, it's $400. It's coming out this spring. It's kind of affordable. And then he said, technologically, this seems like a no brainer. It's expensive, but he thought he could afford it. But then he said, but I'm really concerned about Facebook and the way that they use my information. Should I buy this headset? And I just thought, I don't really have a good answer, because I'm concerned about Facebook and how they use their information. I also love VR, so from a purely technological standpoint, I would buy that headset. But then there are all these other concerns, and I would wonder how that will change the growth of VR and the perception of virtual reality.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that topic is so high on everybody's mind right now that anything that has Facebook attached to it automatically ends up right back to the, yeah, but what are they doing with the data? Seriously,
they haven't
proven to be very given people right. a lot of good feels as far as that's concerned. How would you compare pre Facebook Oculus to where Oculus as a group seems to be right now? Because I mean, you had a lot of contacts from Oculus. I'm assuming most of them don't work there anymore? Or I'm not entirely clear on how your access worked, but pretty different mentalities in the teams. Were they happy or were they bummed, like the team in general, when Facebook kind of swooped along?
Oh, it's a really great question. I think that, you know, in the moment, the fact that everyone at the company had equity, so everyone was essentially instant millionaire if they were not already, it's hard to not be excited about that. And it's hard to not be excited about what Facebook initially kind of like promised to Oculus, which was the same way that they acquired WhatsApp and Instagram, where it was almost like you could almost think about their investment as like a Series C, like yes, we are buying you, but we're going to let you remain completely autonomous. We're basically just the financial resources to you. We're going to let you do your thing, keep doing your thing. So it's hard to not be psyched about that when it happens, though that does change over time. And that's, you know, why I said like inherently that changes. And so coming to terms with that is a big deal. But I was telling my wife the other day that, you know, I got that access in February of 2016, and that lasted for about 2.5 years. And obviously, I still do have pretty good contacts at the company that I still talk with, even, you know, unofficially and whatnot. But it does feel like what part I was telling her was like, it was almost like I got this access at the very height of everyone's excitement. And then every month since then, people have just been more and more unhappy, and sort of like a visit to Willy Wonka's factory. Like one by one, they just keep getting fired or resigning, or like, you know, get these Oompa Loompas coming out, sing a song, goodbye to Palmer and Brendan and all these people. So that's been kind of sad. But like I said, you know, they all sort of think that they made the right decision. So that's where you get into this weird thing of, I guess it's like a difference between, professional happiness and product happiness. And I think that like when you asked about the early days of Oculus, it was so fun and scrappy, and everything was like up all night, like very, very Wild West, trying to figure things out. And fortunately, they always did seem to work out. So that, you know, that's really fun. And everyone is wearing so many hats because it's such a small company and you have such limited resources. And then when you get to Facebook, resources are not really an issue. The company is now grown to over 1,000 people. So it's just not as fun, but the product, you know, the people there are very proud of the product. So I think that they all care. Well, not all. A lot of the early people care about VR enough to say that, yes, it's not as fun for me anymore, and that's why I'm leaving, or that's why I got fired. But you know, look at what we made.
Right.
And we wouldn't have been able to make that otherwise.
Right. Absolutely. The product is pretty great now. The Oculus systems and what they're promising, definitely something to look forward to. Speaking of access, this is definitely kind of part of this whole story. Kind of more behind the scenes, but maybe talk a little bit about kind of your access at Facebook. And you're kind of talking about, like, as the months go on, things start chipping away, and this kind of falls into that territory. You had access through Facebook, and then you started to realize at some point that you were getting fed the wrong information or misinformation. Like, what was that all about?
Yeah, sure. So, the way that my access worked with Facebook and Oculus was that they would introduce me to anyone at the company and do so in a supportive way. Like, you know, we've been working with this guy, or we've been talking to this guy, and, you know, hey, Jason Rubin, or hey, Nate Mitchell, like, you should talk, you know, if you would like to talk to Blake. And it was always up to the employee. So I just wanted to make that clear. And then once I had that relationship with them, you know, Palmer, Nate, Brendan, Mike, et cetera, then that was just our relationship to have. And we could talk as much or as little as we chose to. And so I think that pretty quickly Facebook regretted that sort of setup, given the botched launch of the Oculus Rift and how poorly that went, how poorly they handled the communications around it. But then it really became an issue after Palmer became the most hated person in Silicon Valley. And for viewers or for listeners who aren't familiar with what happened with Palmer and his exit from Facebook, it's a complicated situation. My book tries to unpack it. There's a lot out there on the internet if you want to search for it. Mm-hmm. But the short version is basically that in September of 2016, Palmer donated $10,000 to a pro-Trump organization whose goal was to put up billboards across the country. This GU organization was founded by a couple of moderators from a subreddit called The Donald. And they phrased it as that they were going to post across America, by which they meant put up billboards. But, you know, there was some colorful language there to describe that. Cut to a week or so later, the Daily Beast published a story on September 22nd, 2016, whose headline was that Facebook billionaire secretly funding Trump's meme machine. And the insinuation was very much that Palmer was funding like a sort of a troll factory, and that he was the reason why you had seen so many terrible memes on the internet during the election season, you know, like anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, misogynistic, transphobic sorts of memes. Then that story spread to actually say, you know, like Ars Technica said, that he's the guy funding Trump's racist meme machine, and on it went. From, you know, I think there was not a lot of truth to what happened, but what was true was that Palmer was a Trump supporter, and I often wonder if the reaction would have been similar just based on that alone. But anyway, he ended up taking 24 hours to respond to the news reports, the allegations, and writing a statement that said that he was actually planning to support Gary Johnson instead of Donald Trump, which was I knew was not true, unless he had changed his mind in the last day. I had been talking to him a lot about his support for Trump, because I definitely do not and did not support Trump and was curious why he did. And then anyway, 6 months after that, Palmer was fired. At the time, in March 2017, Facebook provided no explanation for his firing. And Palmer, who I continued to have a relationship with, was never able to talk about any of that stuff with me, nor was he then really able to talk about any Oculus stuff with me after that. So I think it was pretty clear that there was some sort of NDA signed and all that. Then flash forward about a year into early 2018, and I'm working on the book and trying to finish up my draft. And I was out at Facebook's campus in Menlo Park, and I made it very clear to the people there that one of my biggest concerns with the book was how to handle Palmer's exit, because Palmer was one of the, if not the main character of this book, and I couldn't just have him like exit, like the language that they used to not say whether he was fired, whether he was resigned, what happened. I needed to provide some color for what happened, and that, you know, in some ways that's why people would be reading my book, because they wanted to know what happened, and maybe I couldn't get all the information, but I needed something, and something is what they provided me, and it turned out to be not true at all. And they, you know, told to me through a handful of people, high level executives, people who were positions to speak on behalf of Facebook. They told me a story about how Palmer had decided to leave on his own volition, and how he wanted to start this other company, and how, you know, after that incident with the donation, that, you know, like Palmer had basically been back to work and it wasn't really that big of a deal. And then unrelatedly, he just chose to leave. And that sounded somewhat plausible until I brought that to some of my sources and they kind of laughed at it. And with their help, I was able to get at what actually happened. And because this was such a sensitive topic, I wanted to make sure that my version that I depicted in the book of what actually happened wasn't based on what Facebook was telling me or what people who were maybe supportive of Palmer was telling me, but on actual archival documents that I could obtain. And once I got that, it did make a little more sense why Facebook was lying to me, because in the aftermath of the controversy around Palmer's donation, Palmer had written a statement that explained that, you know, a lot of what you were reading was not true. Here's what was true. Here's what was not. And that he was a Trump supporter, and here's why. And then he had not been allowed to post that statement because he was not allowed to publicly voice his support of Trump. And then Mark Zuckerberg personally wrote a statement for Palmer to post that said he would be voting for Gary Johnson, and that Palmer needed to post that if he wanted to keep his job. And as we've established, you know, Oculus was his baby, and he really wanted to keep his baby and keep his job. And so Palmer posted that, and it turned out to not be true. It's also illegal to force an employee to lie about their politics. And then anyway, once I found this out, I didn't want to outright bring this to Facebook, because I didn't want to give them the chance to make up a new version of the story, because they were already sort of correcting on other things. For example, they told me that Palmer wanted to leave, and then I said that, you know, I later learned that on December 4th, like 3 months before that, Palmer had written a statement to his colleagues saying he wanted to be at Oculus for the next 50 years. So it seemed weird that he would want to leave. Then that led to a, you know, a new tweak on their story. And so anyway, what I came to believe, and I don't know how this could not be true, but I because of my narrative nonfiction writing style that we've talked about throughout the course of this conversation, which by design does not attribute the information to specific sources so that people could speak to me without it coming back to them, I basically realized that they were trying to launder the misinformation through my writing style, and that there was a pretty solid chance that they would succeed because I was hearing from multiple different people the same accounts. It was all being confirmed. So I had 2, 3, 4 sources, and I also wasn't getting any other story from Palmer because he couldn't talk to me. And so believing that that was the case, I sent them a chapter that was just a transcript of a conversation that I had with one of their high-ranking employees. And the point of that was to actually reveal the names of the people who was talking to me. This was an on-the-record conversation. And once I did that, they severed the relationship with me because the information was tracing back to a source. And I guess at first they asked me to not publish it, and suggested that it would be bad for me, and that they would, you know, people there would be really disappointed and no longer be supportive of my book. But I thought that it was really important to publish the truth here because of the role that Facebook plays in our current culture, because of their continual problems with lying to the public. I guess the final 100 pages of the book basically feel like a completely different book.
Yeah.
The book got into topics I never anticipated with politics and Trump and memes and all that. And it felt particularly hard for me to do this stuff as a writer because I really don't like President Trump, then candidate Trump. But I felt that what happened to Palmer was really, really unfair. And fortunately I was not alone in that. You know, a lot of people at Facebook, the ones who got me the information, who leaked the documents to me, it was because they too were also from various sides of the political spectrum, but they felt that what happened to him was really unfair. And the last thing I'll just end on that point is it's one thing to lie to the public. It's one thing to lie to a journalist. I think those are both terrible things, especially for a publicly traded company. But this is also, you know, Facebook is not just any company, and they're not even just a super powerful company. They're a company whose entire ethos has been built on openness and transparency. Mm-hmm. Mark Zuckerberg sort of like famously attends the town halls every week and seems to answer any question. And I do think that for the most part, they are pretty sincere about that openness. I don't think it's just lip service, but I do think that when push came to shove, they just abandoned their principles, and not just with me, not just with the public, but also with their own employees. You know, a lot of employees were eager to read my book to finally find out what happened to Palmer because no one told them anything during this whole 6-month process. And that was just very odd to me for a company like Facebook to not live up to these principles that they talk about all the time.
Yeah. Fascinating play-by-play. Like that last part of the book was, you know, there's just so much. Hi, what's your cat's name?
His name is Itchy.
Itchy. Nice name.
Hi, Itchy. Company.
Itchy can't hear me.
But yeah.
That's okay. No, it was fascinating. That whole play-by-play through the, is particularly the Daily Beast chapter, like the, you know, because you did a really great job of including kind of the relevant emails and the timeline and everything like that. And I think what that does, like, I think the general, like, caring, like, public that actually cares about this topic, about, you know, knows who Palmer Luckey is, cares about VR, either is a pro or a, you know, anti-Trump supporter or not supporter. Like, everybody has, I think, at this point, some sort of well-defined personal opinion on who Palmer Luckey is because of that Daily Beast article. And this is this was kind of the first time, like, reading through this part of the book where I was like, wow, you know, that was really kind of crappy. Like, he, you know, obviously everybody made mistakes, right? Like, he should not have done that. He was not, he was irresponsible. He was sloppy in what he did. But it really was blown far out of proportion. And I think it does kind of tie into the times right now. You know, the press by and large, right, is under intense scrutiny around being factual, or in some cases being non-factual. And so there's just a lot of eyeballs on this right now. You got to get it right. And, you know, I think there was too much potential here to be steered in certain directions because of the politics of the time. And ultimately that led to Palmer's, being let go from Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there. Like, for one thing, I think that, like most people, I assume that, you know, yeah, the media has some biases and like it's not perfect, but it's nowhere near like terrible. And it's not like the fake news that Trump always talks about. And by the way, you know, I definitely do not think the press is the enemy of the people. So right. I'm not in that sort of space. But having a front row seat to what happened with Palmer really did change my perspective on how the media operates. Because, like, you know, all that stuff I just described to you about Palmer's final 6 months and his firing and Mark Zuckerberg drafting the statement that Palmer had to post, you know, that stuff is very serious. I think those are very serious allegations. And my perspective is always like, the more serious an allegation, the more the media would, you know, do their homework. Like, yeah, you know, this was not a frivolous thing like, oh, Palmer, he cosplayed in Japan. And as we saw from the document sheet, from the trail of emails, like they did the opposite. And then the other weird twist to the story, which is interesting to me as a journalist, but potentially not to most readers, was just that the way that Palmer spoke to the Daily Beast was supposed to be anonymous. They weren't supposed, yes, to reveal his identity.
Yes.
And so, right, that was a thing where, you know, I know that he felt wronged by that. But at, sure, the same time, like, that was very much like a fruit from the poisonous tree argument. So, like, yeah, you know, I think that the police, you know, or, you know, investigators should follow all the protocols, and that's why we have a court system and all that. But in the, you know, court of public opinion, we usually don't care like how the evidence was obtained. We just care what's true and what's not. So I wanted to at least give the reader everything through these email chains so they can form their own opinions. But like, all that really matters is what's true and what's not. And at the end of the day, Palmer made a $10,000 donation to an organization whose entire contribution to the world was to put up one billboard that said "Too Big to Fail" with a picture of Hillary Clinton's face looking somewhat characteristic. You know, nothing unsavory about that. And their plan was to do similar things like that in the future. And the way that it was portrayed as like Palmer was, you know, a mustache twirling villain running a troll factory, was obviously not only untrue, but to your point, like, I think that has really colored the way that people think about Palmer. And then even once you find out it's not true, like, I still think that you have that gut instinct of like, yes, but I remember I had this feeling about,
yeah,
this guy.
Yeah. So it's hard to undo.
I don't know how you get rid of that.
Yeah. It's really hard to undo. And that's unfortunate for Palmer. But yeah, once that decision is made, it's really hard to undo that, to wipe that away. We're kind of reaching the end of the interview here. I wanted to ask you one question that's not necessarily related to the content in the book specifically, but Goldman Sachs, I saw, projected that VR is going to be bigger than TV by 2025. 2025 feels pretty soon to now. And I'm just kind of curious your thoughts. Like, I love VR. I think it's really great. It's really hard for me to envision VR being bigger than TV, whatever that means, by 2025. But I don't know. Do you feel good about the state of VR right now, where we're at right now and where it's headed, or do you have doubts?
I mean, as a VR fan, I would hope so, but no, I would bet a lot of money that that's not the case. I think that, just based on, you know, as someone who likes VR, has seen its potential applications and its current applications for the past 3.5 years, I'm as bullish on the future of VR as ever. But from a, you know, a commerce standpoint, I think that that's way too pie in the sky. You know, I think when I first started on the book, a big reason for me, like, you know, I mentioned that in a sense, the book was essentially me trying to answer the question of like, I just took this thing off my head. I think it's one of the coolest things ever, but what's the business here? And what was so great about back then was that the business was video games. You know, Oculus's tagline was literally step into the game. Their you know, platform was, or, you know, like their messaging was like, buy gamers for gamers. And so I felt like, you know, the gaming industry is very big. There's a lot of people with disposable income. This is a great step to get us to mainstream VR. But then after the acquisition, it was like, you know, steps 1 through 10 didn't really matter. And they just wanted to get to step 11. And that's I think that that's I don't think that was successful. You know, I think that it, to me, what happened with Oculus would be the same thing as somebody, you know, tapping Mark Zuckerberg on the shoulder in 2005, which I'm sure that they did, and said like, hey, you know, this Facebook thing, or this is the Facebook thing. This is really awesome, but you know, it can't just be for college kids. It's got to be for grandparents and everyone. And eventually it did become for grandparents. They're probably like some of the biggest power users, and that's great. But the road to getting it to grandma was not to directly go to her, because I think that it would, you know, you need to reach that critical mass first, and you need to get these network effects going, and you need to make it somewhat aspirational. Yeah. And I feel like they skipped all those steps with the launch of the Oculus Rift, which is a really awesome product, but it's not the product that's designed to be the perfect gaming VR product. I think the HTC Vive is much more of that, and even the PlayStation VR is kind of more of that, or at least it's much more affordable. So I think that they have really had problems with the audience that they're targeting, and more so trying to sell to the audience that they want instead of the audience that's out there right now or that could be out there. And so I find that very concerning. But you know, like an optimist and like a VR lover, I always hope that the next big piece of news or the next big product release is going to change everything. And so I hope that Oculus, the Quest, changes everything. But unfortunately, I'm not super happy with the state of VR right now, and it's nowhere near where I thought it would be. I wasn't someone who thought, even back when Goldman Sachs released that, I would have my opinion would have been like, wow, that's, you know, two or three or four times too high.
Yeah, right.
But I think that we're looking at a multiple much smaller than two or three or four. But hopefully I'm wrong.
Yeah. Well, history will tell the tale, and well, maybe you'll tell the tale, but you'll do a follow-up.
Yeah, sequel.
The history of the future, Oculus, Facebook, and the revolution that swept virtual reality. Fantastic book. It's a long read, but it's an easy read. Like you're gonna find yourself turning the pages pretty quickly on this one. Blake J. Harris is the author. And Blake, it's been really great talking with you. Thank you so much for spending some time with me today to talk about your book, and congratulations.
Awesome. Thank you so much. This is an awesome conversation. I appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
All right, Blake, we'll talk to you soon, and we appreciate your time. Triangulation normally records every Friday at 2:30 p.m. Eastern, 11:30 a.m. Pacific. This is actually pre-recorded, so we did it a little bit different, but you can usually look for the show to record every Friday at those times. You can watch it live if you like, twit.tv/live, or just head over to the show pages, twit.tv/TRI or twit.tv/triangulation if you just want to keep it easy. There you're going to find podcast subscription links, so you can subscribe to the audio version, the video version. You're going to find all the information, all of the past episodes, all 380 some odd, almost 390 episodes, all different interviews with amazing people like Blake. You know, and you can learn a little something about technology, history, whatever you happen to be passionate about. I bet you there's an episode in there talking with someone who designed it or knows a whole lot about it. I love doing the show. So thank you so much for allowing me into your ears for an hour. I'm Jason Howell. We'll see you next week on another episode of Triangulation. Bye, everybody.